Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's House Speaker is continuing to push a sanctuary city ban, claiming the move will make cities safer.
It's a real crisis. It's a real threat to society.
Inspired by a three-year-old boy, Florida lawmakers are working to ensure children are not left alone in hot daycare vans.
I filed this after my community was shaken by the death of Miles Hill, a child who died after 12 hours of exposure to temperatures up to 140 degrees.
And we'll get a look at what the legislature is doing for people with disabilities and head to South Florida, where a bold new photography exhibit is about to premiere. That's ahead on Capitol Report. Welcome to Capitol Report. I'm Lynn Hatter in for Tom Flanagan. First up tonight, a debate, one that's played out over the course of the 2018 legislative session and got some extended time in the spotlight Tuesday, with House Speaker Richard Corcoran debating Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum over immigration. The two have sparred over the issue via social media, and as Regan McCarthy reports, both used Tuesday night's debate to double down on their positions.
Gillum is a Democratic candidate for governor, and Corcoran, a Republican, is expected to join the race. Gillum and Corcoran agreed to debate immigration policy after the speaker released an ad depicting an undocumented immigrant shooting a young woman.
A young woman gunned down by an illegal immigrant who should have been deported, but was protected by a sanctuary city.
Gillum calls the ad offensive and says the speaker should apologize and take it down.
In his ad, he decided to outfit his version of an undocumented immigrant, or in his words, an illegal immigrant, in a hoodie, as if that point would be lost on any of us in the same state where Trayvon Martin was killed, for wearing a hoodie, quite frankly.
The video shows a man wearing a hoodie shooting a young woman as he walks through her neighborhood. Corcoran told a group of reporters Tuesday the ad isn't a portrayal of a specific event, but the ad ends with Corcoran telling the story of Kate Steinle.
When I heard Kate Steinle's story, I thought about my own daughter, Kate, and how this could have happened to any family anywhere. Incredibly, some Tallahassee politicians want to make Florida a sanctuary state. On my watch, Florida will never be a sanctuary state.
Opponents argue the ad mischaracterizes the Steinle story. Steinle was killed in 2015 when a homeless undocumented immigrant, Jose Inez Garcia Zarate, found a gun under a park bench in San Francisco. The gun accidentally discharged and a bullet ricocheted off a nearby building before hitting Steinle. A jury found Zarate not guilty in Steinle's death. But Corcoran has made HB 9 a priority this legislative session. He says the measure would ban sanctuary cities by requiring law enforcement officers to hold undocumented immigrants they've arrested for 48 hours after notifying federal officials. It's a move, he says, will help to protect the state's citizens by keeping what he calls undocumented criminals off the streets. Gillum argues the proposal violates due process because a person may be arrested, but that doesn't mean they've been charged. But Corcoran says an undocumented person doesn't have due process rights.
All err on the side of victims. All err on the side of citizens every day of the week over criminals and illegal immigrants.
Gillum says the safety of Floridians is his priority, too. But he worries the policies in HB 9 could hamper law enforcement officers who are already struggling to earn and keep the trust of community members. He says that is currently a difficulty faced by the Tallahassee Police Department.
In my experience as a mayor, what we've seen is that the best kind of policing is policing done at the community-based level, where officers are building relationships and sustaining relationships that are in community on a daily basis. What this bill does, in my opinion, and what others like it coming at the federal level, is disrupts the important trust that must exist between the people and the police officers who serve them. Such efforts to disrupt that harmony, disrupt that relationships, makes it much more difficult to get folks who are the victims of crimes or have observed crimes to come forward and to share what it is that they know.
Gillum says local law enforcement officers should be able to do their jobs just as immigration officers must be allowed to do theirs. The House Sanctuary City ban passed on a 71-35 vote in the House. It appears to be stalled in the Senate, but Corcoran says there's still time for the measure to pass. Both men are presently ranked low in polls of potential gubernatorial matchups. A recent University of North Florida study found both had little name recognition in the state, despite Gillum's primetime speech at the DNC 2 years ago and Corcoran's position as Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
All daycare vans must include a safety alarm under a bill that passed its first Florida Senate committee earlier this week. As Sasha Cordner tells us, the measure stems from the death of a young boy left in a hot van last year for almost half a day.
Around 8 on a school night in August, Brenda Watts called the police to say her grandson, Miles Hill, never came home. She was expecting him to be dropped off by Little Miracles Academy.
It's 8:07, and they said my baby ain't go to school, but he went to school this morning. I gave them the payment and signed the papers for my baby this morning. And it's after 8 o'clock, and they ain't got my baby home yet.
Orlando police initially worked the case as a missing child investigation, but OPD Chief John Mina says they later found the three-year-old. Miles had been left for close to 12 hours in the daycare van with temperatures reaching about 140 degrees.
The daycare worker picked up Miles and other kids in an attempt to drive them to the other Little Miracles Academy on 2514 West Colonial Drive. She returned to the daycare center on Plymouth and did not realize that Miles was still in the van.
In a release video, an OPD detective tries to open the same doors as Miles would have if he tried to exit the van on his own. And the detective shows with the locks in place, it's very difficult to get out.
I'm able, if I use my thumb to do it. I'm a 44-year-old male, weighs 195 pounds, and I'm using great amount of force to get it to open. But at locked, if Miles was not able to manipulate that and wasn't aware that the manual lock is here, in a locked position, I cannot exit the vehicle.
The head of Little Miracles Academy, Audrey Thornton, later apologized to the family.
I'm sorry for your loss. Y'all to be upset with me. And I loved it, Miles, and I took care of Miles since he was a baby. And if y'all could forgive me, I'm so sorry.
Thornton has since had to close both her locations permanently. According to the Florida Department of Children and Families, the daycare driver who's been charged with Miles' death never did the required headcount, and the daycare has been cited before for other violations in the past. According to Police Chief Mina, Miles became the fifth child in Florida to die last year from being left in a hot vehicle. At the time, Governor Rick Scott called it a tragedy, hinting at possible legislative changes.
My oldest grandson's 5 and a half. I've got one as young as a little less than 2 years old, and you just can't imagine this happening. Anytime this happens, people ought to be held accountable. You should always step back and say, okay, so what can we do differently? If there's something that we can do, is something that DCF or there's a legislation that we can do to hopefully prevent this?
Now, Orlando Democratic Senator Linda Stewart is carrying a bill called the Child Safety Alarm Act.
The bill requires daycare vehicles used to transport children to be equipped with a reliable safety alarm system by 2019. I filed this after my community was shaken by the death of Miles Hill.
Florida ranks number 2 in the nation for children left alone in hot cars, and Stewart says the least lawmakers can do is to ensure the safety of kids in child care facilities and large family child care homes.
Sadly, horrific deaths like this always seem to happen in all over the state, and the Department of Children and Family Services will test various systems to provide a list of the most reliable. The systems described in the bill are inexpensive, but no matter the dollar involved, the long-term cost of horrific, repeated, and preventable instances of children dying is something that we as lawmakers in our state cannot ignore.
While that measure passed its first Senate committee Monday, its House companion has not yet had a committee hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, advocates celebrated Developmental Disabilities Awareness Day by speaking to lawmakers about their legislative wish list.
While our children's abilities may differ, we oftentimes share the same feelings, that no one wants or cares about our loved ones at all.
A photography project in Miami is inviting viewers to really look at the bodies of women with disabilities.
It got me thinking, you never see beauty and disability and sexuality together.
And Florida's student population is more diverse than ever. But 50 years after the Civil Rights era, the state's schools are resegregating. We'll hear from Floridians who've tried integration before.
And if you haven't really come together in that mind, you aren't really, you can be seated in the same space, but you haven't really integrated.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.
Welcome back to Capitol Report. I'm Lynn Hatter. Tuesday in Tallahassee was a day for love and awareness. Governor Rick Scott marked the day as Developmental Disabilities Awareness Day. Andrew Quintana reports advocates took it as their cue to ask for their legislative priorities.
Richard Bradley is the chairman of the board for the ARC of Florida, a nonprofit organization that promotes and protects the human rights of people with developmental disabilities. The 40 years he has spent helping individuals with developmental disabilities began at home with his sister, Kathy.
Kathy had a measured IQ of about 23, so she needed supervision. She was very capable of doing many things, but she needed supervision. Supervision is literally a matter of life and death for those less capable.
Those that provide such supervision are direct care workers, a job Bradley performed for his sister. But he says inconsistent direct care staff is a concern for many. Over the last 10 years, the national turnover rate of direct care staff has reached 70%, meaning 60 to 70% of direct care workers switch out of the homes they are working in. Bradley attributes this turnover to a lack of funding for providers.
30% of the providers of direct services have abandoned the field over the last few years. Think about that. 30% of the people or the organizations that have been providing these services have abandoned it completely over the last couple of years.
The ARC of Florida and the Developmental Disabilities Council joined forces Tuesday to plead their cases for increased funding in developmental disability services, transportation providers, and job training programs. Their efforts have led to Governor Rick Scott proposing an $89 million budget plan for developmental disability services. However, Barbara Palmer, director of the Agency for Persons with Disabilities, says there is still a ways to go. The Senate has proposed a $66 million budget plan, while the House spending plan includes nothing. She says failing to provide enough funding could hurt families waiting on help getting services through waivers.
Waivers started back in the 80s, and at that time, some of the parents were in their 20s and 30s. They're now in their 60s and 70s. They need help to take care of their individuals, especially their loved ones, especially to keep them in their homes.
Palmer sympathizes with the plight of the direct care workers as well, and urges the legislature to pass laws that provide caretakers with a livable wage, not just a minimum wage that is non-recurring.
We're asking for that to be recurring money, because every year, if it's non-recurring, you have to keep go back in to ask for it.
Both organizations urged families to continue speaking to their representatives for the remainder of the session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Andrew Quintana.
More than a decade ago, Shelley Baer was working with an organization that supports people with disabilities. Somebody suggested making a fundraising calendar, Nudes of Women with Disabilities. The calendar never happened, but the idea lingered with Baer. WLRN's Sammy Mack interviewed Baer about her new project.
It got me thinking, you never see beauty and disability and sexuality together.
Baer had juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. It hindered her growth and left her with visible disability as an adult. Baer is a social worker and leader of several training programs at the University of Miami's Medical School. And she now runs the Bold Beauty Project, an all-volunteer photography series focused on women with disabilities. At the end of this month, the series goes on display at the Jackson Memorial Hospital Rehabilitation Center. Baer spoke with me about the project.
Why specifically focus on women with disabilities?
I guess we were looking at beauty, you know, and stereotypes and sexuality. And women have it a little harder than men in that sphere. And you add a disability into the mix. So there's a little more stereotypes, I would say.
One of the images is a portrait of a woman who appears to be underwater, kind of swimming out of her wheelchair, and the way it's lit, rays of light are coming down on her, but there's also the hard architecture of the wheelchair there. What do you see when you look at this picture?
I see freedom, and I see beauty. Like, she seemed very strong and powerful.
How have the photo shoots changed the way that you look at yourself or that you hear other women who do this look at themselves?
It's really changed the way I've looked at myself when I did it originally the first time. I had poor body image, and I never really looked in a full-length mirror. It really changed how I see myself. It was kind of like a aha moment that I am beautiful, you know, like kind of owning it, because people tell me I'm beautiful, but of course my family and friends, but until you really believe it and own it, you know, that doesn't mean anything. Oh yeah, you're saying that because you're related to me. But then just seeing how I was portrayed and how the image came out, that is me. If I had had something like this experience when I was a teenager, of course, not the nudity part, but the body image part and the self-esteem, that would have saved me a lot of years of therapy. I never saw women in the media or the fashion magazines that I devoured that looked like me. And that's part of one of the missions and visions of our project, is to improve that. You know, I've heard so many stories of women that have done it and were just transformed as well.
I think a lot of us are taught from a very early age that it's not polite to stare, particularly at somebody who may have a disability. But this photo project really invites just that. It asks you to look at women in a way that you don't normally see them. What kinds of reactions do you see from people who are really looking at these images and these women?
Their reaction is overwhelming and so positive, and they're really taken aback. They begin to see disability in a different light.
What is the change that you hope to inspire with this project?
Looking at disability in a new way, creating new standards of beauty, that you can be beautiful, sensual, sexual, and have a disability. And I think this does achieve that.
I'm Sammy Mack.
Finally tonight, Florida's student body has never been more diverse, but the state's schools are also becoming more segregated. A recent study by the Leroy Collins Foundation shows a marked increase in intensely segregated schools, spurred by demographic changes and the rise of private and charter academies. To understand why these changes are happening, WFSU looked back at Florida's attempts at integration. This school year marks the 50th anniversary of the closure of Lincoln High School, an all-black school in Tallahassee. Shuttering Lincoln sparked wholesale desegregation in the state's capital, and it was a reckoning for Leon County's students, teachers, and administrators, black and white. Reporters Kate Payne and Nick Evans bring us some of those experiences 50 years later.
Oh, my God. Oh, I'm trying to think. I could tell you so much about Lincoln and talent shows and... Oh, we listened to Sam and Dave and Otis Redding and Sam Cooke and, oh my God, James Brown. And I mean, miniskirts were coming into to style. I am Irene Gillum. I am a Tallahassee original. And I am a graduate of Leon High School, 1969. My mom had graduated from Lincoln, and her diploma was on the wall. And my oldest sister and my oldest brother had gone to Lincoln. The sisters, six of us, the sister ahead of me, she was at Lincoln, and, you know, I knew I was going to Lincoln. I was going to be a Lincoln graduate also.
My name is Altamiz Barnes, and I am a native of Tallahassee, fifth generation. And we are at the what we call the old Lincoln School, the original Lincoln School, here on West Brevard Street. And then the classrooms started here. Miss Harden, I think Miss Lily Harden taught English in that room right there because I took English from her. Can't remember what that room was.
When we went to Lincoln in 10th grade, we had no clue that it would be closing at the end of our 10th grade year. None whatsoever.
We were informed like a week or two, probably no more than a week or two before, that we would not be coming back to the historic Lincoln, original Lincoln, because the school was closing. I think these are yearbooks over here. I think it's that blue one. What year is this down here? Lincolnian. These are prom pictures here. These are queens, and see, these are the things that blacks used to could do. But when the school desegregated, it took a while for you to even get invited to be a part of the social life.
That was a difficult transition for them. They were the leaders of their school, and they come into a new environment, and nobody changed the policies for them. There will be X number of minority kids in this club and this club, and they had to start from scratch, really. Mike Connolly, I was principal at Leon for many years. I can't remember. I started there in 58 and left there in 89. People viewed things with a different set of glasses than they do today. They weren't aware of the social injustices. They didn't think there was anything wrong with it. That's the way it had been done. That's the way their mother and father were brought up.
My name is Bill Matice. I'm a 1968 graduate of Leon High School. So many of us, and I put myself in there, we were just kind of nonplussed about it. We don't. Probably should have done more, but we didn't.
I grew up in a somewhat different household. I felt like virtually everyone in Tallahassee was a segregationist, and my family favored integration. I am Ann Sherhorn. I'm a retired professor at Kent State University. When I was a sophomore, I entered Leon, which started with the 10th grade. The most dramatic memory I have was my first assembly at Leon High School. I was just a little sophomore, and we got through the assembly, and at the end, the band struck up Dixie. And I was wondering about the few black students who were sitting in the back of the auditorium together. I just wondered what they were feeling.
I wondered every day if I was going to have to fight. Every day when I got to the top of that hill going down to Leon, I had to wonder if this is the day I'm going to have to fight.
We weren't ugly, but we weren't, reaching out across the aisle.
That's the kind of tension that I think most of us, if we're willing to admit it, that's the tension that we really felt during those days. Is this the day that I'm going to have to defend myself?
I don't have any regrets. I know that I did everything that I could do to make things right and do the right thing. And I think most teachers felt that way too. It's just a fact of life when you get all of those personalities. You put 2,300 people on a postage stamp piece of property and tell me that they're going to get along when their parents can't get along.
For me, integration is a thing of the mind. And if you haven't really come together in that mind, you aren't really, you can be seated in the same space, but you haven't really integrated, you know, like the water mixed with whatever, the jello, to make it really this thing. So it's not really integration. It's you just desegregate.
And a special thanks to Nick and Kate. Nick left us earlier this month, and today is Kate's last day. Congratulations, you two. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Lynn Hatter. Tom Flanagan will be back tomorrow. Join us each day for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.